南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello, friends. How are you today? I hope that you're in good health and secure. First day of October. This year, at times, has seemed very, very slow, and at other times, bewilderingly fast. Ah, the nature of time, yes? So we are in the midst of a lengthy introduction by presumably Daisetsu Taro Suzuki, the author of this translation of the Lankavatara. But I think there's tremendous value in this introduction for two reasons. Number one, he delves into specific concepts of Mahayana Buddhism, which for some people, for some is a departure, if you will, from Hinayana or earlier teachings, or even the Agama Sutras, the earlier periods of Shakyamuni's teachings. I would argue that he's been teaching the same thing all along, albeit to a different audience. And to his credit, Mr. Suzuki has addressed that, the capacity of the people, the, I think he called it mentalities of the people, in the skillful means portion, yeah? So I think that's probably the most important takeaway as far as Mahayana or the teachings in general. But certainly, as you and I know, the Mahayana teachings represent a deeper scholarship in the understanding of the Buddhist method for recognizing the mind, how it works, what its natural tendencies are as an emergent property of a physical universe, which is our whole attachment, desire, syndrome of possessing, right? Accruing, craving, which he talked about, Shakyamuni talked about from the very start. That's why I say it's not that he changed what he was talking about. He just changed how he was talking about it. And once he gets to a certain level of understanding and practice and memorization and enlightenment in his audience, the teachings shift a bit to a more I want to use the word clinical, but he was telling expedient means, he was telling stories before Mahayana, but in the Mahayana there's a greater depth of focus into the actual mechanisms of the mind, what it is in the scope of the practice to understand what's going on in the mind and how we make our delusions, how we construct a reality that is false. And that false reality is what precipitates all our stresses and anxieties. So how to reevaluate, how to escape from, how to eschew the construction in order to then experience freely and contemporaneously the life as it is instantiating, the life as it is prior to samsaric instantiation, but just the flow of life, right? The energies that are being formed into physical reality and appreciate that mechanism prior to the forms, therefore liberating us from that attachment to form. What does that look like? How does my mind perceive without this identification, without this grounding reality, quote unquote? This becomes the central focus of enlightenment potential. The awakening from the physical to the clear, perceptive, moment-to-moment experience. Buddha. That is what we call Buddha. Right? Not a person, not a personage, just a mental capacity for perception of the ultimate truth of the process of life. Without all the stuff, not the stuff so much, but the attachment to the stuff, the mechanism of contrivance, of constructed reality. It's still there. We're in the physical universe. There's no denial of that in Buddhism, although many sects, especially early sects, interpreted via their capacities this annihilation kind of thinking. It became very nihilist, but that's not ever what Buddhism was about. But you could see how it could be seen that way if it weren't perceived completely, clearly, what Shakyamuni was trying to help obviate. Okay? So, in that regard, the Mahayana dissects a lot more the behavior of the mind. And Mr. Suzuki is spending a lot of time dissecting the dissection so that there's, as an introduction to his translation of the Lankavatara, he's trying to put forth this, shall we say, program of context around which the Lankavatara explores enlightenment. Okay? So this next paragraph here is titled The Ignorant. So he wants to identify from the samsaric or the Mahayana perspective, what does he mean when he speaks of the ignorant? Because we hear that all the time. The uninitiated, right? So what does that mean in Mahayana terms? So here we go. Life as it is lived by most of us is a painful business, for we have to endure much in various ways, right? Life sucks, then you die. Who hasn't heard that, right? Our desires are thwarted. Our wishes are crushed. And the worst is that we do not know how to get out of this whirlpool of greed, anger, and infatuation. Interesting. I will remind you again that anger, in Buddhist terms, is not about okay, that's really the world of hell where you're enraged and so forth. Anger, in the context of the realms, is, this is interesting because anger, again, Buddhism is about the mind, attitude and intent. So in that idea of thinking, attitude and intent, what is anger? See, it's not this violent release. Anger is more manipulative. It's an attitude. It's a circumventing way of behavior. So anger becomes backstabbing, manipulation, working around, lying. All of that revolves around the idea of anger. Because if you're not being truthful, honest, clear-headed, then you have an agenda driving you and you're trying to manipulate your environments. And that's the world of anger, because there's no respect, no regard in that. Follow? And then the next word, infatuation. That's not talking about the pretty eyes of a possible lover. Infatuation is our distractions, our monkeys, our constant, ooh, that looks good. Ooh, that's pretty. Ooh, look how that shines, right? The shiny stuff. That's infatuation. That's pulling us from our true self to a collecting, possessing self. The cravings are infatuations. We know this because as soon as we possess, we move on to the next thing. Oh, I own that now. Whether it's physical or metaphysical or, you know, whatever. Once we feel we have something, we no longer respect it because the respect is in the getting. That's samsara in a nutshell. So these little word hints, they're important to dissect and understand, yeah? And so what Suzuki is talking about here is that in our ignorance, we're driven by this alone. That's samsara, right? And that life is a painful business and we have to endure much. That's our perception, because when I can't have that, when I lost that. So it's not a real, he's not saying life is a painful business. He's saying the way we live it is a painful business. Follow? How do we get out of this situation? We are at the extreme end of existence, opposed to that of the Buddha. So now he's setting up the duality for us. We live in this samsaric, constant craving reality, and yet it's not reality, because it's a constructed reality. Constructed of what? Our cravings. And at the other end of the spectrum is Buddha. No need for cravings when we are everything. What are you craving? Right? I don't know what analogy you could put into samsara. Maybe a funny image would be, you know, a little you sitting at a table with everything you could probably desire to eat, being fed to you by pretty lovers until you're about ready to explode, till you're, quote, sick of food, and yet you could still look around that table and go, man, I'd love that strawberry. Right? That's samsara. And at the other end, you see the food, you smell the foods, it's wonderful food, but there's not a single speck in your mind that says you must have it. Because you have it right there displayed in front of you. No reason for you to fill yourself up till stretched skin, bloated discomfort. That's silly. There's no need for that. You have it all laid out in front. Wow, isn't this amazing? Just the smells alone fill you. Do you think you could do that? It's a flawed analogy, but what is this Buddha? Well, he's saying it's the opposite, or the other end of, to be more accurate, this attached craving existence. It's certainly not this craving existence. But it doesn't wipe the whole table clear of all the stuff. It's just how it's experienced without the cravings. Or to be more accurate, without the greed, anger, and infatuation. How can we leap over the abyss and reach the other shore? Now, that's a poetic, a simile. But what does it mean? We read this other shore rhetoric throughout all of Shakyamuni's teachings, right? We're on this supposed shore of a flowing body of water, and our entire practice is on getting to the other shore. Well, if you look at that objectively, so what? It's just another one side of the river or the other is still the side of a river. But the analogy is, or the simile, however you want to read that, metaphor, is that the flowing river is life. It's the flow of energy. It's energy manifesting moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, all of its potentials. And the shores are your observation of it. How do you experience it? More than observation, how does it affect your experience? Now, I've used a similar analogy about rapids, going down a kayak in the rapids, right? Very treacherous. Constantly the possibility of smacking your head on a rock. The kayak turning over and you're having to turn it back upright. Navigating these rocks and eddies and flows of water. It's tumultuous. It's crazy. So my analogy of life, far more animated than simply a flow of water. But it's the same thing, right? And when you're in it, your heart is beating, your adrenaline is going, and your life is in danger. But if any of you have ever been in or around rapids, you know, just standing on the side of the rapids, the volume, the sounds, the smells of the water and the wet rocks and the moss and the violence of the turbulence. It impacts you physically. You can experience quite a lot of the rapids without being in them. And you can do a pretty good job of imagining what it would be like to be in them. It's frightening. Let alone observe somebody in a kayak negotiating such a thing. But you're in the safety of the shore. You can observe all of that in the rapids and the kayaker without throwing yourself into it. In a much safer place. So I take the simile maybe a step or two further. Because I like the analogy, this flow, it's constantly going. Can I experience it from an objective place? Or must I throw myself in the rapids in order to know what the experience is like? This to me is a more visceral, contemporary analogy, maybe. But that's my analogy of the rapids, yeah. It's the same thing. Standing on one shore, you're getting in your kayak and you're going into the rapids. Or you're staying safely on shore and walking the rapids and observing them. You can deeply appreciate the rapids without putting yourself at risk. This is a very sane idea, yeah? So whenever you see this in this simile or analogy or metaphor come up about reaching the other shore, and notice he says, how can we leap over the abyss? So for Suzuki, instead of the river, the water body, he perceives an abyss, a canyon, a chasm. I would argue that the water analogy is more relatable, but still using the same rhetorical devices, yeah? He goes on, the Mahayana diagnosis of the conditions in which all sentient beings are placed is that they are all nursed by desire as mother who is accompanied by pleasure and anger, while ignorance is the father. I don't like that rhetoric. It doesn't read very clearly. But if he's being true to old rhetoric of earlier teachings in other languages, those words had a different compass of meaning. So we'll allow him that. Basically, he's just identifying our infatuations, our relationships with the phenomenal world. To be cured of the disease, and you know this is very consistent in Buddhism, what is disease? What is sickness under the guise of dis-ease is a very good word to use because it's dis-ease. We are not at ease in our lives of attachments. We're constantly battling with possession and loss. Yeah? Samsara. And so from the Buddhist perspective of liberation, emancipation, and the amazing consciousness of Buddha, any version of this other in the rapids is dis-ease. It's a sickness to be cured. It's a delusion to be removed from because it's constructed. It no need be there, right? While ignorance is father. Now, that's not to say that being a father is ignorant. It's saying that ignorance precipitates this behavior. And it's coddled, mother-like, by our fascinations, infatuations. So he's finding another way to say the same thing. To be cured of the disease, therefore, they must be put to an end to the to the continuous activities of this dualistic poisoning. The dualistic poisoning is this contrived reality. That contriving it is our first level of attachment. By identifying it, identification. And then our grasping, craving, holding on to it is our profound dis-ease that we're maintaining. And somehow we need to divorce ourselves from that constant behavior. When this is done, there is a state called emancipation, vimoksha, which is full of bliss. Again, the language, full of bliss. What's it full of? Okay, so this is just language, having its moment again. But to be emancipated, one is no longer full of contrivance. To be emancipated is to be released from all of the cravings, the poisonings, the sickness, the dis-ease. What does that look like, right? Because to a human mind, that's not where it's focused. One could argue that to experience that kind of, quote, bliss is almost unknowable to a human samsaric mind. There might be specific moments where a taste of it enters our minds. I've used the analogy of when a mother first looks upon her newborn child. There might be that sensation of just amazement, but it's quickly clouded by possession, right? Ownership, greed, anger, and infatuation, right? And we mistake all of those contrivances for love, but that's not love. Love is that moment of amazement that transcends the pain, the effort, the process of samsara, and opts into a process of simple, utter amazement of the process of life. That's real love. But boy, it's a fleeting, fleeting moment, if even experienced, because the nature of craving is so overwhelming, yeah? The Buddhist question is thus, he says, quote, how is emancipation possible? How can you shift your perspective, your understanding of life itself, as you see it, as an attached being, to this detached being? How in the hell can you do that? The mind is just far too quick at adhering to stuff. Yeah? And here rises the Mahayana system of philosophy. So he's identifying Mahayana as a more developed system by which to emancipate our minds. Well, it's not the first time Shakyamuni talked about this. Talk to any Hinayana Buddhist. They'll tell you, yeah, that's what being a Pratyeka Buddha is all about. That's what being an arhat is all about. But be careful here. Because to be an arhat, though it may sound like the same words, is a very egotistical position. An arhat has not disconnected themselves from the rapids. All they've done is made the kayak. It's like after the rapids, the river either goes through a waterfall or it goes through some kind of, the rocks are gone and it calms down, the river widens and the flow goes slower, right? You've seen this. Rapids are just for a period. And so an arhat, it stays in the same body of water, identified, I am an arhat, although no longer in the rocks and the rapids, just floating along. Well, that's an accomplishment, but you haven't left the darn river yet. You still don't have perfect, complete emancipation. You've just reached a level of it. Now you must be a bodhisattva. Pick up your kayak, get out of the water, and start influencing the world around the river from a place of emancipation, to bring others to emancipation, and now you will discover things about yourself you had never considered. Because it is through others that we explore our life experience, all of life, more completely, not just our isolated ego of it, identification of it. See, it's still there. So Suzuki is saying Mahayana is a far more comprehensive understanding of what it takes to liberate oneself, emancipate oneself from what he said is greed, anger, and infatuation. So then he uses an older term, into the next paragraph about the turning back, the paravritti, sorry. I'm not sure if that's Sanskrit or Pali, but anyway, I think it's Sanskrit. To this philosophy, a special paragraph is devoted below. I wish here to say a few words concerning the important psychological event known as paravritti in the Lanka and other Mahayana literature. So what is this turning back idea? Paravritti literally means turning up or turning back or change. Technically, it is a spiritual change or transformation which takes place in the mind. Okay? Especially suddenly. And I have called it revulsion in my studies in the Lagavatara, which, it will be seen, somewhat corresponds to what is known as conversion among the psychological students of religion. So you see, as I identified earlier, Suzuki is still operating from this cultural bias of Buddhism as religion. This is what allows him to talk about salvation and other words of that sort. And I've already made abundantly clear throughout all of my videos that Buddhism is not a religion. Buddhism is a conviction of mind. Buddhism is a methodology for emancipation from our own contrived worldview. It's our mind and the way that it functions, much more akin to a science than a religion, unless you force religious ideas and ideologies into it, which is a heinous thing to do. Because Buddhism is so straightforward, right? Look at my recent video. What is Buddhism? It's about reason, rationality, clearly seeing what is, as opposed to an averse to the constructs that make us suffer, because they're not true. They're illusions that we create for ourselves in some blind ambition to maintain everything in a certain state, permanence, which is what we're doing, permanentizing everything. I have you. No, you have this moment, and I'm with you in this moment, and isn't that amazing? You don't own my moment. You only own yours. See life clearly. So the turning back, we've already read enough in here to see how that is a useless use of language, because the turning back, I would say, is more of a religious kind of thing, looking at things like going back to purity. We're not going back to, we've adopted a maneuvering posture in life as this instantiation moment to moment to moment that is a delusion, that is not really what's happening. And we want to release ourselves, emancipate ourselves, liberate ourselves from that gargantuan miasm of illusions and rise above it, if you will, or outside of it, or going to the other shore of it, and observe it for what it is rather than what we would like it to be. And believe me, when we see what it is, whatever we thought we wanted it to be will be so pale and minuscule and useless, defiled, that we will no longer have any desire for it at all, because we will have reached something that is the size of the universe itself, right? The engine of life. Is that a turning back? You'd have to work really hard with language to make that make sense. So I would rather, like he said, you could call it a change or a spiritual transformation. As he said, takes place in the mind. Especially suddenly. Now, why he would then call that a revulsion, I've heard that translation before. And when you and I think of revulsion, we think, ew, yeah. But I believe the way it is, he's attempting to use that word, and it has been attempted by other authors, is a getting rid of, a purging, a lack of any desire to return to. A revulsion, as in, this is no longer of any merit. A clean break. Much more attuned language to what we're doing in Buddhist practice, yeah? If revulsion works for you, fine, but just understand what you're really saying, yeah? It is significant that the Mahayana has been insistent to urge its followers to experience this psychological transformation in their practical life. Yeah, I like that statement. That agrees with everything that I've studied and I've talked to you guys about. That Mahayana is about experience. And a perceptive, psychological transformation in their practical life. What's the practical life? This idea of samsara. This day-to-day coursing through samsara, albeit with a psychological experience that is unattached, emancipated. Well, what is that? That's living as bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a state of mind in this apparatus body, coursing the world with an attitude, a perceptive attitude and intent based on emancipation, based on Buddha-ness. That's what we're all doing, right? And by the time, long after the Lankavatara, he teaches the Lotus Sutra, there is the formula. There is the condensing of all of this knowledge into a practical self-enlightenment. How do we course the world with a Buddha mind? Namo myo renge kyo. That is verbatim, that process. Namu, I commit my practical life to Myoho Renge Kyo, Buddha-ness, Buddha enlightenment, Buddha way of experiencing. Namu, in this samsaric life, I hereby resolve Buddha. That's the whole formula. Now, formula, I'm a little leery of using that word, but I think you understand. It's our act of bodhisattva, our initiation of bodhisattva in our personal experience of life, which we then course through practical life with influencing others, assisting others, because we have no choice, not because it's our job, but because from our vantage point, our clear experience, how could we not rescue those in the rapids? Rescue. Influence those in the rapids to come to shore. and then to influence them that bouncing around in the rapids isn't real life. It isn't. It's a torture test you're putting yourself through for the adrenaline rush, for your attachments. Come here. Look at the insanity of what is happening moment to moment here, which is such a major step in experience that it makes your adrenaline rushes and fears and all that other motivation pale. It's so meh. Yeah. Compared to this. A mere intellectual understanding of the truth is not enough in the life of a Buddhist. The truth must be directly grasped, personally experienced, intuitively penetrated into, for then it will be distilled into life and determine its course. I like that sentence. That agrees with what our purpose is in Buddhist practice. He's basically defining the life of a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, without labeling it so. But let me read it again. A mere intellectual understanding of the truth is not enough in the life of a Buddhist, like a Shravaka or Pratyekabuddha or even an Arhat, who has memorized every sutra, who knows every word of every sutra in its various forms. Knowing intellectually, there's some merit to that, but as a Buddhist, all of that is in servitude to the experience, the moment-to-moment actual experience. You can intellectualize all day long, but unless you experience it, you really don't know. And so in that vein, the truth must be directly grasped. You must experience it, personally experienced, he says. Not by reference, not by intellectualism, but as a guttural, visceral knowing. Intuitively penetrated into. For then it will be distilled into life and determine its course. When it's beyond a cellular doubt that life is unattached, that directs your continuing experience of life. Not your clothes, not your sex, not your possessions, not your food. Those are all just interesting supports. They don't have the craving attached to them anymore, the infatuation. They're just helpful waters making you buoyant. This paravritti, according to the Lanka, takes place in the alaya vijnana, or all-conserving mind. Now that's interesting, because we know from the 9 consciousnesses that the alaya is just the 8th, which is assumed to exist behind our individual empirical consciousness. So, in case you've forgotten, the alaya consciousness is the repository of all our karma. It's that freight train of karma that I constantly refer to. The instantiation moment to moment of the energies that amalgamated into this mind of realization that our tendency is to assemble identification and build an ego, a me, an I. The all-conserving mind. Conserving what? The energies of formation. Which is which is assumed to exist behind our individual empirical consciousness, the way we experience life. The Alaya is a metaphysical entity, and no psychological analysis can reach it, because psychology is about stuff. It's about the phenomenal samsaric world and our relation to it. That limits psychology to a samsaric experience, dualities. What we ordinarily know as the Alaya is it's working through a relative mind, the mind that emerges from that freight train of karma is completely infatuated with its own manifestation, physical manifestation, craving. That's what we're basically made of. So it's no wonder that's where we end up, experiencing all our cravings. That's samsara. The Mahayana calls this phase of the Alaya tainted or defiled and tells us to be cleansed of it in order to experience the paravritti for the attainment of the ultimate reality. So in that sense, the turning back then is to return to a state of non-phenomenal manifestation. But that's a weak understanding of Buddhahood, you see? Because that places Buddhahood or enlightenment or detachment, emancipation, as a prior condition. But that's because we're in the Lakavatara stage here and we haven't gone beyond that understanding yet. Buddhaness is timeless. So it's not really a turning back to prior to instantiation. No, full enlightenment is being in this instantiation and understanding that Buddhaness is concurrent. Because it's without time. It's in this moment, this moment, this moment. You don't need to go anywhere else on the timeline to discover your enlightened mind. It constantly abides. It is the formation of this universe. The only thing that's separated is our awareness of it, our constant use of that lens. That's why we chant, to look through that lens, to be with that lens, because it's ongoing. So that's why this turning back is kind of like, what, where are we going? It's not complete. That is a critical point when reading this sutra. And it's also a critical point of understanding why divergent schools like Chan or Zen took hold. This idea of leaving behind to go elsewhere, whether it's time-space or however you view it, that's a fallacy of language, of understanding. Do you see? It's a very critical point, so don't miss it. Paravritti, in another sense, therefore, is purification. Now see, that's not a going backwards, is it? It's contemporaneous. So here's this seesaw of understanding, misunderstanding, understanding, improper rhetoric. But let's move on. In Buddhism, terms of coloring are much used. And becoming pure, free from all pigment, means that the Alaya is thoroughly washed off of its dualistic accretion or outflow. That is, that the Tathagata has effected his work of purification in the mind of a sentient being, which has so far failed to perceive its own oneness and allness. Being pure is to remain in its own selfhood or self-nature, while paravritti is psychological. It still retains its intellectual flavor as most Buddhist terms do. So I see Suzuki struggling with what I've been talking about here. Do you? This, he's still wrestling from a samsaric perspective. And, you know, let's face it, language is samsara. So to be emancipated, and it's funny to hear him use the words colored, because I've been doing that recently, right? To see through colored lenses, colors of our own making, our cravings, our infatuations, yeah, does not allow us to perceive what's actually being colored. Because all we see are the colors. So this transcendence of cleansing the mind of all the colorings should avail us to a clear, ultimate experience, a view, understanding, participation. And that Buddha mind, uncolored, can enjoy the colors for what they truly are. Just manifestations of potential. We don't own them. They don't own us. Being who we are without the ego baggage of what we think represents who we are, eschewing all of that, simply being of mind, of consciousness of the process, is more akin to this enlightenment, this awakening. Yeah. And we could see, as you listen to me and we read Suzuki, this linguistic struggle with identifying, yes, joke is purposeful, pun intended, Buddha-ness. Because it's unidentifiable. It's an experience. And that experience is only, can only be and occur in one place. The mind. Without the mind, there is no Buddha. Because Buddha is a definition of how a mind perceives emancipated, clear of colorations. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Please like, subscribe especially. That supports this channel, gets it out to more people. That's what I mean by support. It does some bodhisattva work. So let's use the algorithms to propagate this teaching, yeah? So thank you to all of you who do that. Those of you who can extend your support a little further to financial donations or equipment or whatever to keep this channel, first of all, afloat, let alone stronger, better videos, whatever I can do to support your practice. That is the goal. Stay strong. Be kind to yourself. No sense in beating yourself up. We are human beings. We make mistakes, including me. I don't apologize for them. I just realize they're part of the phenomenal samsaric world. But that's what makes our sangha strong. Yeah, we can all share our own perceptive wins in our practice of Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. So be kind to yourself. Keep your practice strong. Even if nothing else makes sense, please keep your practice strong. You will burst through whatever it is that your mind is infatuated with. Yeah? We'll all get there together and we'll influence this world and everything in it to be a mirror of our own enlightenment. Yeah? Okay. Thanks again. I'll see you soon. Bye for now.